Welcome back to another episode of The Political Life. Today, we are very excited to bring you, I would say, a different type of guest. In my reading, Melissa Dargan is the guest today. And Melissa and I have never met or spoken before. And I like doing this once in a while because you have no idea what we're going to talk about or where it's going to go. My description of reading Melissa's bio is that she's an entrepreneur, a bit of a politico, and just has a lot of different things going on. And I thought it would be very interesting for us to hear from someone like her who, in my interpretation, worked on the Hill and is now doing a bit of an entrepreneur type thing, which I bet there's a lot of people doing, and we haven't really tapped into that world. And so we thought we'd do that today. And we're very excited, Melissa, to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Jim. I'm excited to be here.
So, Melissa Dargan, you grew up in California and you went to Berkeley?
I did. Go Bears!
To start off with a really stupid question, what was Berkeley like? It seems like it'd be a great place to go to college.
Berkeley is a very interesting campus. There's a lot of culture there. I will say, not going to lie, walking to school, you don't know what you're going to run into. One year, they had protesters up in trees. And so on my way to class in the morning, there would be like the morning, hey, good morning, looking up because there were people living in the trees trying to save them. And so there's always activity on campus. So there was never a dull moment.
Wow. That is quite, it's hard to cut down a tree if there's someone living there.
Exactly. And they lived there for months on end and people would, so there would be a bucket. People would put food in there to help them be sustainable. And then I think they also had whatever means to, you know, use the bathroom. But I think that's where also like the root of activism and politics really honed in on and had me go in that direction, just because Berkeley was always one of a kind.
That's a great story. And how did you end up on Capitol Hill?
So I ended up doing an internship my last semester of college, which most of my friends thought I was crazy because most people go abroad, you know, junior year. And for me, I never went abroad junior year. And my abroad was Washington, D.C. And that was my choice. And to be fair, D.C. is its own world. But my last semester, I decided to do my internship because I figured if I wanted to end up staying in Washington, D.C., finding a job, it was a great segue from college into finding a job and continuing that after graduation. So I started off as an intern in the UCDC program and then worked for a California member. Was really blessed because working for Representative Royce was one of the best experiences I had. And also in the stories that I've heard from other interns and other staffers, I feel lucky that Representative Royce was such a great boss. He learned my name the first week I started, and I was just an intern. And I know some interns who never had FaceTime with the member of Congress that they worked for, much less know their name. So I've really felt like part of the team. And then during that semester, ended up before I graduated getting a job offer. You know, when stars align in Washington, D.C., where there's shifting movement, and then they're like, oh, there's an opening for the staff assistant position. Because I had worked there, did a good job, I got the job offer. And then I was like, oh, do I go back to the Bay Area and take a private sector job or do I stay in Washington, D.C.? Made the call to stay in Washington. And that's how I ended up on the Hill.
That's great. And how long did you work on Capitol Hill?
Okay, so I was on the Hill for 4 years and 8 months. And for anybody, yeah.
That's a pretty good tour of duty.
Quite a while. And I only thought I was going to be there for 2 years, go to law school and, you know, had that mindset and ended up loving the job. Also, Representative Royce became the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee after 2 years. And that position to end up also working on the Foreign Affairs Committee was something I couldn't say no to. That being said, leaving 4 years and 8 months, there's a 5-year pension vesting mark on Capitol Hill. And I know I talk about personal finance, but this is what helped me realize some of the mistakes I made on Capitol Hill and just not knowing. Nobody really talks about personal finance. And had I known, I would have stayed that extra 4 months. Right. I didn't. And I left too short. And now I either have to go back onto Capitol Hill to hit my pension vesting or I forego everything because it's either you hit it or you don't.
go back for a little short 6 month tour of duty and and qualify. Yeah, boy, what an interesting work that you must have got to participate in. When you look back, what are some of the highlights that come to mind?
One of the highlights, I would say, so on policy wise, one of the issues that didn't really fall into an issue area. So on the foreign policy committees, they have it by region. And one of the issues that came onto my purview was inter-country adoptions internationally. And I look back at this and I just feel a lot more connected because so families who were adopting from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, from the US ended up being stalled. And I would get letters and read through this, and none of the professional staffers were really focused on this area because they typically just take countrywide. It was so interesting to delve into inter-country adoptions, find out what that looks like, the bureaucracy that both, you know, the United States and other governments have, and then the issues that are happening abroad. But eventually gathered enough information, found out there were nearly, I think it was 1,000 or a little bit more than that, families in the US affected across the United States. Meeting with them and eventually getting a number of those kids home was one of the most rewarding things I had worked on, alongside my boss and other members of the committee who then jumped in and were very vocal about it. So bringing those kids home to the United States was a big deal.
And why were they stalled?
So they were stalled. The Democratic Republic of the Congo had been undergoing at that point a leader who elections were coming up, but from my understanding, didn't want to step down. And there were a number of things happening on that end politically. And then separately, there were accusations that in the Democratic of the Congo, people were not allowing children who were actually like legally supposed to be adopted. There were some cracks in the system and allegations that some of these kids were not supposed to be in the adoption system, that there was fraud. And so they just halted kids leaving the DRC because obviously if that's the case, they didn't want children who were being kidnapped to then be adopted abroad.
And when you say they, who's they?
The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Okay. Boy, and you had to go through all this and figure out how to deal with all that. That must have been some real in-depth work on your part.
Yeah. I mean, from doing the research in the US and figuring out how the State Department works with this, and then also then figuring out, okay, what's happening in the DRC? Like, why are children not being allowed to leave? And then also hearing then the heartbreaking stories of families. There was one family I had worked with where the mom had already flown to the Democratic Republic of the Congo thinking that the child would be allowed to leave. And she was there for months. And then her husband was in the US with their two kids. And just hearing some of these stories, like some people said, well, okay, then just give up on the adoption. But man, the moment these parents lay eyes on the children that they are hoping to adopt, they fall in love and it's their kid. They're not about to leave them. And so just hearing some of these gut-wrenching, heartfelt stories of the families was really why I was so involved in that issue. Because at the time, nobody was listening until they had raised it with Representative Royce. And our chief of staff, Amy Porter, had gone through an international adoption of her daughter from India. And so I knew that this would be an issue that really mattered both to my chief of staff and my boss.
How satisfying was that when you, at the end, when it started to work itself out and these adoptions started to come through in a more efficient manner?
I mean, seeing the joy of the families being reunited was really emotional. And then also, I think one of the things for me is one of my deal breakers, fun fact, is when I was talking with Garrett was, hey, are you open to possibly in the future adopting children? And that was one of the things for me I thought was very important. Like, yes, growing a family, having kids, I would love to have that at some point. And then also at some point, if Garrett and I are at a good spot, would like to have the conversation of adoption. But one of my deal breakers was potentially being open to adoption. And if he said no, I was like, see ya, no more dates.
And Garrett, for our listeners, is your fiance?
Yes, Garrett.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Well, that's wonderful. What a great story. And then I interrupted you. You were about to tell us another highlight, I think, from the your time.
Yes. So with Representative Royce working on the Foreign Affairs Committee, another highlight was being able to travel and seeing the world through a different lens. I think people forget that, you know, when the United States is making foreign policy and things that will affect global perspectives, making sure that you actually had gone to visit that country, understanding the culture is super important. Because there are things where if you are just living in the US and you're creating a resolution to condemn a country, that has ramifications abroad. And I didn't also realize how interconnected a number of things were, that policies that we made or did or did not do and follow through on would echo from like the Middle East all the way to Asia. And so being able to travel, experience the culture in various countries, both Asian countries and Middle East, Europe, was really cool.
And traveling in that manner is just a unique experience. I mean, you know, you're representing the government, you're with the government, and you're meeting all kinds of interesting people and interesting meetings. That truly is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Exactly. I mean, my first congressional delegation that I staffed, Chairman Royce, was a 5-country, 10-day trip. So, you know, we're flying out of the U.S., you sleep, you wake up in Japan, then you get on board, you sleep, and you're waking up in Taiwan. It was such a whirlwind, but I would not change that for the world. And I know, you know, like salaries on the Hill are not the most lucrative, but then you also look at the experiences that you're offered, and I just couldn't say no. So even though I thought at the time, I'm going to go to business school, I was in the midst of taking the LSAT. When Representative Royce was offered the chairmanship and he took the committee, being able to travel, I knew was going to be such a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I didn't leave the Hill again for another 2 years.
So you mentioned the LSATs and business school. How did you decide which to do? Because many people on the Hill, usually they tilt towards the law school. You went the other way. How did you ultimately decide to attend business school?
Yes. So in the midst of taking the LSAT, I had always thought I was going to become like go into politics and then go into law and bring my passions together. And my grandfather was a lawyer in the Philippines and became a judge. And so this was something I thought I was going to do growing up. When I got to DC and I was studying for the LSAT, I started to really think, because people say, right, that's almost a $200,000 investment. Like you got to know you want to be a lawyer. And I had a number of friends going into law school. Some of them, after they graduated, started to rethink whether or not they wanted to do law. Then instead of doing, you know, legal work, they pivoted directly out of it, went into VCs, went into banking. And then I thought to myself, do I really want to go to law school? I said, okay, I'm just going to take the LSAT to then keep my option open. But this is crazy. And I actually think there are signs in the world. I don't know all the signs that what like globally it's telling me. But while I was taking the LSAT, first of all, I started off, I think, at like a 140, which is like the worst. It's out of 180. And I always taught myself, it's a beatable test. It's a beatable test. And for 6 straight months, I woke up very early, 5 a.m. in the morning, from 5 to 8 before work, would drill into practice tests. And then the 2 months leading up to the test, every Saturday at the exact time I was going to take the test, would start a mock test. The 2 Saturdays prior to my main LSAT, I sat down 8 o'clock, ready to crack it open on a 4-hour test, was by my window. In the middle of my test, a bird flies into my window and like, I think it breaks its neck, but I was so startled and I was like, oh, and then it threw me off the rest of the test because you're so into it. So then I was like, okay, I'm not going to finish this practice test. The next week, the week right before the LSAT, I'm again, sat down Saturday, 4-hour test. Middle of my test again, another bird flies into the window, like right by where I'm at. Oh, and I'm just thinking to myself, this has never happened in the 3 years I've been living in my house, in this window. Like we've never had this happen. And just so happens to hit it during the middle of my LSAT. Needless to say, I think I was like, okay, this is a sign. Like, I'm really unnerved. And I still took the LSAT, but then in the back of my mind, I was like, there's something telling me like law school is not the way to go. In the midst of traveling abroad alongside while I'm still working on Capitol Hill, I also started to notice the importance of technology and business abroad and how important that was in innovation and just bringing new things and creating. And so I started to think, well, maybe it's not law school, it's business school. And also on working on the Hill, I was fortunate enough that there are many individuals who come to Washington, very good, like important businessmen and women. Bill Gates was actually meeting with my boss on his work in the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it was in that meeting with Bill Gates that I started to really kick the heels in my head where I was thinking business school was going to be the path down for me, because seeing him come to Washington, and you know, in DC, everybody clamors to get members' time, maybe a 15-minute meeting. When Bill Gates came onto Capitol Hill, the members were trying to get meetings with him. And then also seeing what he created, not only with Microsoft, but then the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the good that they were doing globally, the impact that he had, I was like, if you really want to change the world, creation is where it's at. And how to create is in the private sector and being able to potentially, you know, build your own foundation if you're so fortunate to have built a huge company. And that's where the shift from law school and doing legal work to becoming an entrepreneur and creating and possibly building an empire was first seeded in my head.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, you're sitting there and you're thinking that, you know, go to law school, possibly run for office, become a member, or do other things around that. And then you see Bill Gates and you're like, well, wait a second. Here's somebody who's gone a different path and almost in a lot of ways, maybe many ways, has more influence, and all the members are trying to meet with him. That's a very interesting moment that you had. And then didn't you get some time with Bill Gates because they needed someone to guide him around or something, and you jumped at the opportunity? This I love this story because this is like, you know, you have to be kind of aware of your surrounding and jump at opportunities. So tell our audience this story.
Yes. So when Bill Gates came into town, his team is very efficient. They do not waste any time because I think, you know, if you want to calculate how much time Bill is worth every minute, it's a lot of money. And so they called my office and they were like, hey, Bill is coming from the Capitol and he's supposed to meet with Representative Royce, Chairman Royce. Can somebody come and pick us up and bring us straight to your office? They didn't want to get lost. And you know, the Capitol, the underground tunnels, they're pretty complex. And I was—
Yeah, if you haven't been there, it's confusing.
Exactly. And I was like, oh, me, I will raise my hand. Like, I will do, I will go pick him up. And so I went to the Capitol and I picked up Bill. But on the way back to my boss's office, we took an elevator. And this is where I joke. And I was like, man, I took an elevator ride with Bill Gates, but I didn't have an elevator pitch. Because at the time, I wasn't fully thinking business school until after I had met Bill. And, you know, everybody talks about be ready with a 2-minute elevator pitch, because you never know when you're going to be stuck with someone influential, literally for 2 minutes in an elevator, and they have nowhere else to go. Well, that was my moment. And I had a mini epic fail. But instead of me pitching Bill on some great idea, Bill actually taught me something in that quick elevator ride. And it was where I started to see the inner workings of his mind. I mean, he's always thinking about something innovative or more efficient and effective. And in that elevator, he started telling the story about how when he was a congressional page, he thought about an algorithm that would make the elevators go faster, because how slow the elevators were from getting to point A to point B was wasting members of Congress's time. And that's when I knew that, well, first of all, I was like, wait, Bill Gates was a congressional page? He interned here on Capitol Hill? But I also then followed up and read that he, during his time in Washington, D.C., realized politics wasn't for him. That's when he actually wrote it off. And that also served as an inspiration to where I was like, look, he's always thinking about how to make things more effective and efficient. And in a way, government is trying to do that. They're trying to serve the people. But it takes time, right? Policy doesn't happen overnight. And when you enter into the business sector, in something that could change the world in 10 years in government, you can build in 2 years. I mean, look at a number of the companies that have really made transportation more efficient, made agriculture more efficient, and just the inner workings of that. I think you can see how, you know, in the means of if you're trying to change the world, even going outside of politics can be a great opportunity.
It's such a great story that it just shows that his mind is working and thinking like that all the time. Like here he is as a congressional page or staffer as an intern, and he's thinking, you know, how to make the elevators more efficient. I'm sure there weren't a lot of interns or pages trying to figure out how to make the elevators more efficient. So jumping ahead, you go to Yale Business School. And then what do you do when you come out of Yale Business School? Is that when you start becoming an entrepreneur?
Well, so actually during one of my business school classes, it was an innovation class. They were like, innovate an industry that you know. But the only industry that I knew prior was government, right? I had worked straight on Capitol Hill right after graduating. And so I went back and I asked some of my colleagues, hey, you know, for one of my projects, can I just watch how the office is operating? I need to find some efficiencies that I can then come up with an idea and pitch at school. And that's where the company Tour Tracker, the idea was born, because I had started app company prior, but it wasn't gaining traction. And this was at the beginning of business school. And as I started to do more work and delve into research on, okay, what is it exactly that members of Congress or government needs? I saw the inefficiencies of all the manual processes that they do in a member office. And in my mind, I thought to myself, we're in an age where technology is everywhere. There's access to technology to innovate and make things more efficient in all other industries except government. And that's where I saw that tours were still being done the same way I was doing them almost 8 years prior.
And what is that way?
Yeah. So when I was an intern and then staff assistant that also did tours, it was manual. It was Excel spreadsheets, printing out the requests.
So Jim O'Brien is coming to DC with, I don't know, three or four people from the district. I call the office. They put me to the tour person. And I say, we're going to be there Monday at 10 o'clock. And you, Melissa, say, okay, Monday, 10 o'clock. How many people? What do you want to see? Blah, 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 blah. I come show up at the office and you help organize a bunch of things. That's how it worked?
Sort of. So constituents or visitors to DC can call their members of Congress and say, I would like to, you know, see the Capitol, the White House. Most members also at the time had a website where you could go into the website and make your request for tours of DC. And you could only see the White House if the member of Congress made the request on your behalf. And so those were some of the things where why people had to actually go to the member of Congress to make the request. Then once the visitor makes the request, that request comes into the member office and the staffer who handles tours. And from there, either I would populate their requests into an Excel spreadsheet or have a binder full of the requests that came in from the website, because it would be emailed to my email. I would print out that email, put it in a binder, and keep track of all the visitors, the like hundreds of visitors that came into our office for the year, and have to make sure that I booked them, the White House, the Capitol, the Supreme Court, the Library of Congress, the State Department, you name it. And again, members of Congress for most of these sites are the only ones who can make these requests. And so as a staffer, I was basically like a professional tour guide of Washington, D.C., because I had to manage everybody's requests, make the requests with the individual built like Supreme Court, White House, mm-hmm. and then let the constituent know, hey, these are your tours. I mean, I was basically like a glorified tour administrator, and that was all done manually.
But a lot to keep track of.
100%. I mean, not only are you keeping track of individual requests for a family. So, right, Jim, you're coming to DC, let's say with four people. I'm keeping not only track of you and your family, but hundreds of others. And in addition to that, a tour coordinator is not just working on tours 24/7, right? As a staffer, you're also working on staffing the boss at events. You're also doing flags. You're also answering phones. You're also drafting, you know, memos for the member of Congress to read based on issue areas that he's interested in or she's interested in. And so for me, it took up a lot of time. And that's why, you know, people get burned out on Capitol Hill. It's because you wear so many hats and you have so many job responsibilities. Tours was just one of them. But that would take up anywhere from, you know, 10 to 20 hours a week, depending on the high time of tours. Well, that was all manual. And I come back in 2017 at the time to like watch how members of Congress are operating. And they're still booking tours with Excel spreadsheets, copy pasting from Word documents, the constituent or the visitor's itineraries. And it's taking up the same amount of time it was almost a decade before when I was doing them. And at that point, that's when a light bulb went off. And I was thinking to myself, you know, what are the things I wish I had or knew about as a staffer that would make my life better? And that's when we came up with Tour Tracker. I got together with the now CTO, co-founded the company, and we built a digital platform to innovate the way member offices manage and organize tour requests, because 12 to 20 hours a week on booking tours for constituents is crazy, in my opinion, right? Most staffers come to Washington, D.C. to hopefully work on policy or, you know, press. And when you're actually doing more administrative work, which is still very important because you need to care for your constituents, you're not working on the things that you want to come to Washington, D.C. to do.
And putting that aside, let's say you don't care about the staffer and the fact that the staffer is spending 20 hours a week doing this. It's ripe for mistakes and errors and problems. And I mean, 200 groups coming in and, you know, wait, am I supposed to be at the White House at 10 or the Supreme Court at 10? And then they're calling you. And then sure enough, 5 to 10%, something's going to go wrong. And then they complain to the member. Whereas if you put this tool in their hand, you know, they're it's just right there. They're picking Supreme Court, you know, no to the White House or whatever. It empowers them and it makes it, there's a lot less room for error.
Yeah.
So that company was called Tour Tracker.
Tour Tracker. Yep.
.com. And it's Tour Tracker and it's not ER, it's just R.com. And you and the CTO founded that. And is that one of your primary businesses right now?
Yep. So the main company is AppMy LLC, because eventually we may create other products. TourTracker.com is one of the products that we created. And that is my day full-time business. We have over 50 members of Congress now using TourTracker, and we are officially approved in the House and the Senate.
Wow. And so can I, as an individual, go on Tour Tracker, or is it more just from the congressional side?
It's from the congressional side. So our main clients are the members of Congress and their staff who use our platform. And then the visitor and the constituent would receive a email generated by our Tour Tracker platform that says, here are all your tours. Here are the times, here are the dates, and here's extra information that you need in coming to DC.
And then how do you get paid?
We get paid by the member office paying to use the service. So there's like a monthly subscription.
Okay, great. And so really your company is AppMy LLC. That's the parent company where you've created Tour Tracker and you're hoping to do other things. What are some of the other things that you're looking at or that you have done that you can tell us about, Melissa? I know it's all very confidential.
Proprietary.
So anybody that hears this, you can't tell anybody.
We have been exploring other avenues of what else we can build technology-wise that would make Congress work more efficiently. And this is where we're still actually in the brainstorming planning stage, because when you delve into a company, you want to do what you're doing really well, right? They teach you to niche down. They teach you to really focus in business school, because if you don't do that one thing well, you're not going to be set up for success later. And that's why we've actually been so heads down into Tour Tracker, because yes, it was launched officially in March of 2019, but we have been building off of feedback from other staffers to make our platform better. And I think that's why Tour Tracker has been able to grow and maintain throughout COVID our clients. What we do is when I first launched the platform, I let the staffers who use it on a daily basis give us feedback. And based on that feedback, every quarter or every couple months, create new features for them that will be helpful in booking tours. So we've actually delved so deep into the tour booking process that we have had other ideas come into us. Other staffers will say, oh, you did Tour Tracker so well. Why don't you look at flags? Why don't you look at the like scheduling system of meetings for members of Congress? But we haven't fully touched that. It's on the brainstorming board, but we haven't built anything yet because we've tried to do right by Tour Tracker to give it the best success that it could. And now that it has, you know, 50 member offices, we're starting to, as COVID is opening up, talk to more offices and doing demos for them. Once we feel that that's in a good place, we will also start to explore other opportunities with other products.
And then what will you do once you have all 435 members of Congress and all 100 senators? That's really your audience, right? And once you have all of them signed up, then what?
I mean, think bigger. And this is where potentially looking at what we've built for Tour Tracker and how that could be applicable to other state localities if they do their tours of their state capitals. Because what we want to do is build on our expertise and skill set and technology that we've already built. And so starting to also look into state and local may be a possible venture. You always want to think bigger, but you need to start and really hone in on the local of what you're working on first, do that really well, and then expand and grow.
And what about, do any of the offices have the ability for people in their district to go schedule time with the office on an app without interacting with a person?
As far as I know, not directly. Like they still have to, well, I mean, they can go on the website and say, I would like to request a meeting with my member. And I believe that then would go into like schedulers inboxes. Yeah. Or in some cases, they may just call directly the office and say, hey, you know, we're coming into town, right. XYZ. That's as far as I know.
But it still goes on the list. I'm just trying to think of if a member of Congress has, you know, a town hall meeting or whatever it may be, if people from the public could sign up via that way. Now, and let me ask you another question is, if a member of the public is going to DC and wants to visit all of those places, but isn't opposed to going through their member of Congress, but doesn't really care, are there other businesses that do that? And have you thought about that?
So for the main drivers of DC, such as the White House or the FBI or, you know, the State Department, a member of Congress only has access to those request portals. There aren't just open public tours where you could walk right in. And so, yes, there are other tour companies that can, you know, take people to the Capitol and the Library of Congress, because those, at least prior to COVID, had open public tours on the day of. Like, you don't need to go through your member to see those sites. But there are sites that only a member of Congress can get access to, or even if you want, like, there are things such as the Capitol Dome or, you know, getting to see the Speaker's balcony that you just can't go to if you're on a regular tour, that a member office has access to, given the right timing, and then also using their being a staffer and showing their badge can get you onto those areas. Again, I don't know what that will be post-COVID because of the difference in security protocols, but other tour companies could run, you know, seeing normal tour sites that the public has access to, but only members of Congress can access the main ones like the White House and the FBI. And so I wouldn't necessarily want to pivot into just being a tour company because the key driving sites that people want to see, I don't have access to.
Mm-hmm. Well, very smart, Melissa, and really a unique approach and niche that you have. And I love the fact that that's really where you are laser focused on that area and not getting distracted. But Melissa, it has been so great to talk to you. Anything else you want to tell our listeners before we sign off?
I think the other thing that came up during quarantine, so as I work on Tour Tracker and I onboard new staff, a number of times staffers say, oh, you used to be a staffer. And can you, you know, just share with me, how did you live off of, you know, $30,000? Or like, what is this TSP? Is this the same thing as a 401k? And it was interesting to me because I think during COVID, when staffers were all working remotely, they can't really talk with each other. They haven't even met their other coworkers. And the House and the Senate have like payroll and benefits, but they don't get into the nitty gritty of what are these funds that you should invest in the TSP? Or what are even the options? What do they mean? Because they don't follow the normal stock index. They're called like the C fund or the S fund. And it's like, well, what is that? And during quarantine, I had over a dozen staffers, different offices that I would onboard for TourTracker, ask me this separately. And that's when actually I started to kick an idea around of, okay, if I'm spending now 45 minutes with each of these staffers just talking about what I knew and my experience, maybe I should make this more efficient. And that's when I actually created and started to create YouTube videos that then I would share with the staff because they would ask the same questions. I didn't want to continue to repeat it over and over again. And so during quarantine, I actually started a YouTube channel on personal finance with a series particular for congressional staff, where then I share like things I wish I knew as a congressional staffer when I was on the Hill, and just tips and money tricks and money management. Because, you know, when you're not getting paid a lot, you need to be as crafty and as innovative when it comes to making the dollar stretch. And so I definitely wanted to share that with your listeners, because I think, you know, in Washington, D.C., people focus so much on policy and the bigger picture and like helping the world. Sometimes they forget about helping themselves first and focusing on their financial situation. And I don't think people fully realize that even somebody making $30,000, if they started on the Hill at, you know what, 22 and saved for the next 40 years, just 5% of their salary. So that's $1,500 a year, about $125 a month. And that drills down to nearly $4.17 a day. They could retire millionaires just even working in the public sector. And that's because of the power of compounding and investing. But people think because, oh, I only make $30,000, I'll never be able to like reach millionaire status. And I work in public service. But it's like, just knowing some of these small financial tips can make the difference between retiring a millionaire and not.
Compound interest. It's great advice, Melissa. And what is your YouTube channel? So we'll put it in the notes, but why don't you tell people what it is so they can find it?
Yes. So you can go on YouTube, type in Melissa Dargan, and then just find me. I think I have a picture where I'm like waving. It's not hard to miss. So check it out. If you like the content, subscribe, like the videos, because hopefully that will help in making more content. And also let me know if there are any things that the listeners are interested in hearing about. That gives me good ideas for future things.
Well, we will put all this in the notes, and I would encourage people to check it out. Melissa, it has been great to chat with you and great to hear about your journey of going to the Hill and then finding your way, becoming an entrepreneur, and the debate that you had between getting an MBA and going to law school. I think it's a debate that a lot of people in DC are having. And so anyways, it's been great to have you on the show. And for our listeners out there, remember you can follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and everything else. And you can also sign up for our Monday morning email, but it's a lot of times it's not in the morning. We sometimes are late. So now we call it the Monday email, and you can sign up for that at our website, thepoliticallife.net. And it comes out every Monday with the show with people like Melissa and tells you a little bit of more about them and has links and those kind of things. So you can do that. We hope everyone has a great week. It seems like things are opening up and getting much better and better by the day, which is great. So have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.